It's one step at a time. Technically, the Torah tells us when a couple gets married, there are two stages to marriage. Kiddushin, Nisuin. Kiddushin, one can engage a girl by giving her a ring or something of value, and we have witnesses and agreement, they get married at Nisuin, so now he is obligated to her more than he was during Kiddushin. Today, our custom is that we do both at the wedding ceremony. Now, what happens when a couple date and they decide they want to get married? So, today we do an engagement. Today we call them engaged and he buys her an engagement ring. But technically, halachically, nothing has happened. Halachically, you better be very clear when you give her that engagement ring that you're not doing kiddushin. That's not what's happening here. You guys are deciding that Be'ezrat Hashem, at a given date, you will get married. Now, once upon a time, there was this place called Europe. And there were Jews that lived there. And Jews didn't always live very close to one another. One could live in a shtetl to the east, and one could live in a shtetl to the west. And then a shadchan would come to the Jew in the west and tell him, you know, there's a fabulous girl just for you out in the east. So the shadchan would tell him all kinds of lies about the girl, and the guy would get all excited, and then he'd travel to the east and meet the girl. And recovering from the shock of everything the shadchan told him and what he's seeing, he'd come to a decision whether it was right or wrong. And more often than not, the shadchan would sell his load of goods to the parents. And as happened to my own grandmother, she came home one day and saw cake and wine sitting on the table and the Shabbos tablecloth spread on the table. So she asked her parents, "What's the occasion?" So they said to her, "Mazel tov, you're a kala." So she said, "Really, to who?" They said, "Go change into your Shabbos clothing. You're about to find out." That was the way marriages worked down here. My own grandmother, yeah. My grandmother told me that's how it happened. They told her, "Go change to your Shabbos clothing and you're going to find out." Go ahead. Chazal didn't exactly want us to get married that way. Chazal did want the girl to see and decide if she approves or not. And even in those ceremonies, I mean, the girl had a say. The girl could say no. It wasn't so accepted socially that she'd say no. Then again, their expectations for marriage were very different than our expectations for marriage. No one thought about happiness. That wasn't what they were thinking about. There were other issues at hand. But at the end of the day, they'd come to a decision and an agreement that they would get married, and then he'd go back to his town, she'd stay in her town, and they'd prepare for quite a few months and prepare a certain sum of money, her dowry, sometimes they'd buy a house, the wedding preparations themselves cost a lot of money. So if we're going to have a situation where two people come to an agreement that they're going to get married, and yet halachically they don't have anything binding, you have a problem, right? Because what happens if the next day he meets a girl that fits the description of the shadchan? For real. This is the real thing. This isn't what the shadchan was telling him. So then he thinks, well, wait a second. I have this girl who's expecting me to marry her and she's not half what this girl is. So I'll send them a letter telling them I'm very sorry, but I had to leave, right? So the custom became that all over, I mean, throughout Europe, they would write a contract called the tnoim. And they would make a celebration of engagement. Technically, what happened here? Nothing. Two people agreed that in 6 months' time, in a year time, they're going to get married. So technically, nothing really happened.
This is the thing where, like, this family gives the pillows, this family gives
So in those tanaim, that was really serious stuff. People would write out, you're going to fund the pillows, you're going to fund the blankets, you're going to build the roof, you're going to build the second floor. Each side agreed how much money they're going to give him, what they're going to give, and it was a really detailed contract. And people really invested a lot of money in their children's marriages. Now, if someone backed out from that, they'd put all kinds of sanctions against him, because he had signed the contract and people had banked on that contract, and now he's reneging on his word in the contract. Technically, the signing of the contract, after you signed that contract, that's it. You're getting married to this girl. The Hasidim took it so seriously that if a guy wanted to back out, they tell him, marry her, then get divorced, but don't break the contract. The contract was very serious. It was so serious that there are poskim that say you shouldn't write it. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, what kind of contract is this? You're not getting married to her, but you're signing everything as though you would get married to her. What's going on here? So he writes his own version of the contract, in which you basically say, well, if everything works out the way we expect, I'm going to marry this girl. Basically, you're not saying anything, right? That's to keep the tradition. Now, these tanaim were so serious in those days, we're going back 100 years, and by Hasidim still today, that if a girl got engaged and her chassan did not write this contract, the girl would spend the next few months in limbo, wondering, is he for real? Are we really getting married? Everyone else signs a contract, why didn't he sign a contract? To the point where we have a halacha that says that the minute a girl knows she's getting married, she gets so excited that she might see her period out of whack. The excitement could send things out of whack. And the halacha, one opinion in halacha says that if they did not write the tnoim, these conditions, this contract, then the girl never really came to that excitement because she was never sure he's going to marry her. When does she reach that excitement? On her wedding day, when she comes to the hall and says, oh, he's here? It's really going to happen? And then you have a problem. I mean, we have to be worried that maybe then, out of excitement, her whole system went out of whack and she became impure. So that's the extent of seriousness that the Tnom had in those days. Now we can understand that if they're signing such a contract that has such gravity, and without it, people weren't certain if they were getting married. With it, people were certain they were getting married. So it was a pretty joyous occasion. I mean, it's almost like a wedding. People made a big party, and people invited their friends, and people served cake and wine, and it was a big to-do. I mean, by Hasidim still today, it's like that. And just like at a wedding, when we're celebrating and we're happy, we commemorate Yerushalayim, we break a glass. At the Tanaim, we break a plate. And there's an old saying that says, why do we break a glass under the chuppah and break a plate at the Tanaim? Because the plate that we break traditionally at the Tanaim is made of earthenware. And what we break traditionally under the chuppah is a glass. Glass is something which can be melted, and you can make another cup out of it. A couple that gets married, even if it breaks, they could get remarried. That's why he breaks a glass, to show you that even the things that break, they can be rebuilt in marriage. But tanoim, that's like earthenware. Once you break it, you can't rebuild it. No such thing. You stick to your tanoim, and there's no breaking of the tanoim. So that's a vart. I don't know if it has any basis. Maybe someone said it sometime. I mean, someone said it sometime, because everyone's quoting it ever since. I don't know who said it. I don't know whose idea it was. But this custom of breaking a plate, and that the two mothers-in-law, the two future mother-in-laws, break the plate, that custom is a very, very old custom. What started happening in the United States, and maybe elsewhere, I don't know, is that people don't write tanoim before months before the wedding. They don't write it then, but rather, to maintain the custom, and in order to give a few more honors out, if you have a lot of people you got to give honors to, so what they do is they write a tanoim at the wedding. Just before the chasm goes down to the badekin, they sit down and they write a tanoim. What's the big idea? I don't know. I mean, basically what you gain from it is that you could give a few more honors. You could give two friends to be the witnesses, and they sign on the document, and you could give a friend the honor to read it out loud, and if you have too many people that you owe honors to, so you could give a few more honors in the tanoim as well. But practically, what are you signing? In a few minutes, I'm going to go and marry this girl. Good for you. You know, yeah, that's what you're doing. That's what we're all here for. So this is a brief overview of the tanoim, the breaking of the plate, and where the tanoim are today. If someone's going to write tanoim today, it's recommended that they do it like Rav Moshe Feinstein says, unless, of course, he's marrying a Hasidish girl, in which case they're going to tell you what tanoim to write. But then get a good lawyer, get someone on your side. I mean, oh yeah, and it's very serious. I was once. It's not him; it's his father that's schwitzing, right? And there's some serious haggling going on there. What we try to do at Machon Meir is. Very often in other communities as well, it's expected that at the engagement you're going to come to an understanding who's funding what in this wedding, or just before the engagement by what they call the lechaim, when the parents drink a mazal tov together, and we try to encourage the students to have a rabbi present. Hopefully the people will respect the long beard, not me. I mean, someone with a long white beard, Rav Goldenberg, Rav Kaplan, and maybe the David soon. Hopefully the presence of a rabbi there is like a mediator and keeps everyone cool. That's just because you are talking big money. I mean, funding a wedding, funding everything else. You could understand that people can get upset. One parent says $250,000 wedding. The other parent says, I can't afford more than $10,000. They say, well, wait a second. We were at, there was a couple that was getting married. Her father turns to the chassan and says, you think you're buying a horse here? What do you mean, only $10,000? The guy didn't have any money. He was learning in Machon Meir his whole life. So it's good to have someone there to keep things calm. Yeah.
The Rav just said is breaking the Tanayim is worse than getting divorced.
I didn't say that. I said there are Hasidim who are of that opinion.
Yeah.
Well, it all depends on what Tanayim you wrote.
Some people say breaking engagement is worse than breaking.
So, this is like big poskim or whatever say that this is originally Jewish custom, and that even the